Run with the Borg, baby. Assimilate.
Brain Soda.
It's the Brain Soda Podcast. I, as always, am your host, Kyle, joined by my co-host and cohort, Brad.
How's it going?
Today, we're going to be talking about the Aztecs. But first, podcast log, day 390. We travel out into the 58th sector to talk about something, Brad, that I know that you're a little bit more familiar with than me. But regardless of which, I'm well aware is very important. Maybe one of the most beloved television shows of all time. But most importantly, it's one of the most important elements of science fiction. Today, Brad, we're going to talk about Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why I did Shatner, but...
That's all right, yeah. No, I thought it that's worked. Great. Yeah, oh, man. I did watch it. This was actually the only Star Trek series that I watched. I think I watched like a little bit of the next one after that, but it was pretty good, man. It was my fall asleep show when I was like 20 or so. It's been a while.
Yeah, no, and I will say this honestly has a little bit of reverence for me in a similar aspect, because one of the guys who comes in later to help write on TNG, as we're going to kind of refer to this as in a shorthand, just for you to know. But Ronald Moore, no relation, actually wrote Battlestar Galactica's reboot in 2004, and that was my big sci-fi show of my 20s. So I think we both have a level of reverence for this. And I think when we finish this story, we're really going to see why. But to start off with why... In 1986, there was this much reverence for this franchise. We're going to start in the late 60s. Gene Roddenberry developed the original Star Trek, a revolutionary show of its time, involved in like kind of a, you know, 23rd century utopia that had an inclusive cast and really revolutionized the way television shows portrayed people of color, portrayed women, and made those characters able to work together in a day and age when it really seemed impossible for them to be able to work together, right?
Yeah. Like, was he like the sole creator, Gene Roddenberry? Was he like...
Roddenberry is kind of always associated with being the main creative force behind Star Trek overall. But I will say this, in his initial... like attempts to relaunch, reboot, and work within this space, he does often go to grabbing veterans from the series. Even here in TNG, he will start season one with four veteran writers of the original series, right?
Okay. Now, yes. Were the veterans diverse and stuff like the cast was? Because you're right. Like, that was, like, the first, I think, the first black person?
There was one woman notable. There was one woman notably of them. And I will say this, although I don't know of any people of color directly writing for them, right? But I will say that, like, at the time, maybe Hollywood should have emulated it a little bit better. And there was a long period of time. There's even elements of this story that writing for characters of color and women weren't the best. So it's not like we learned the lesson overnight.
No, but it's
overnight.
A 60s show. Right. Like, because I remember, like, I don't remember exactly. There was a black woman on the show, right? In the original.
Lieutenant Uhura, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay. And I think there's an Asian man, too, right?
Or is that, yes. I think there's both. That's Sulu, and that is, what the f*** is his name? Oh my.
whoever though, but okay, those two people though, right? This was
George Takei.
Yes, of course. How did I not? No, George, yeah.
Oh my, we forgot George Takei. Who turns out to be a gay icon like 40 years later too, right? Like,
okay, yeah. That might have helped people that at that time too, because I don't know if it was like...
Nobody used
it. Okay, but anyways, but just the fact that him and the woman were on there, like that was
members of the crew contributing. Yes, absolutely. And that...
Yeah, like there was never her like actually a supporting character that wasn't just like playing like, you know, a black woman playing a housemaid or something like that.
A token.
Or yeah, like the token.
Essentially,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But with that being said, Star Trek actually didn't last that long. It's when TNG surpasses its 80th episode, Legacy, I believe it's titled, that it beats the initial airing of Star Trek. I believe there was like a season or two they did of an animated series. And in 77, Roddenberry and Paramount, right, they were looking to relaunch with Star Trek Phase 2. Those plans really don't come to fruition, and thus we were born. Star Trek the Motion Picture was a little bit more of a reboot in and of itself, but this is all original cast stuff still, right? Those movies go on to get to about a fourth sequel by the time that we're going to start our story proper in the mid to late 80s, right? But just so that we know, there had already been attempts and workings at some sort of a television or, you know, ultimately they were doing a film franchise in the Star Trek universe.
So at this point, when did these movies come out, I guess? Because, like, I know that...
It's, like, late 70s, I think. Maybe even 19... It may even be 1980 proper that the first one comes out. Because you got to think, like, pre-production and shit like that, like, 77 and A New Hope's initial success... is part of what makes everybody willing to put money down.
Oh, okay.
No matter what, the whole time, Star Trek goes into syndication after its cancellation from NBC. And it keeps airing. And it keeps having a return. And it keeps having a growing audience. And it continues and continues and continues and continues. And then initially in the 80s, they were going to reboot again on television with Shatner and Nimoy and the original crew. But Paramount had to shell out $5 million to procure those two actors to reprise their roles in the fourth of that film franchise, A Voyage Home. But comparably, $5 million would produce roughly five episodes, you know, of an hour block of television for these guys, right? So, like, it was not going to be feasible for them to continue on with those guys. Plus their age, Nimoy and Shatner have like kind of an embattled rivalry, I believe.
Really? Well, yeah.
Also at this point has like had kind of crosswords with Shatner as well. So regardless of such, right, like there's a little bit of a stigma and time in there. And Roddenberry, I think, is already looking in the right way to an extent that this television show is going to take place 100 years, roughly, after the events of the original series. And while they were still making these offers and reruns into syndication, I want to go to a 1986 article I found in the New York Times talking about Paramount's decision here, because they looked to all these different stations at this time. So Fox is a broadcaster. They're producing programming for Showtime and USA within the year. But they go to first run syndication because they felt that no one was going to care about Star Trek the way that they did. And for real, this show to me is what makes Star Trek a legacy brand.
Yeah.
For 20 years or so, this was rerunning episodes.
That's why I saw it for sure, yeah.
Right, of original Star Trek. They were running those. But now with these seven seasons that we're going to talk about now that we're starting our story in 86, right, these seven seasons that are about to happen, they go to first run syndications because they know the market base is there because they've already been playing that's 20 years old and people are still watching it, right? And I feel like it's because of things that we talk about on this show, right? Like, Star Trek as a concept is far enough future that we have warp time travel, right? We have all these phasers and holodeck. Well, we invent the holodeck here, I'm sorry. Yet Earth and a unified, structured society in the United Federation of Planets is like, I think, honestly, the lessons that we're learning from Star Trek, that immediate future, that is part of the reason why people love it so much. To see everybody accepted, get along, going towards these goals, and gathering other societies into the fold is a beautiful prospect for society to like strive to, right?
Yeah, because that's like the basis of TNG, is that, right? They're going out trying to...
Of all recruit... of Star Trek, yeah. Essentially, right? Yeah. And when you hear the term like prime directive episodes and things like that. Right. It is to find these other societies and like, you know, not disrupt their like social evolution or whatever you want to call it. Right. Like you can't come up to a primitive race
and bang them
and just hand them warp technology. Like, that's immediately against the prime directive or whatever. But, like, to work within the unified planets and things like that, it is part of it. And they do explore the far sectors of space, typically. But I feel like, just like he was saying, when it comes to the show going to first run syndication, you see Paramount making a bet on itself, or the IP, essentially, here, with the choices that it has in its casting for TNG, right? You know, a classically trained actor like Stewart for Picard, or LeVar Burton's Geordi. You also have, like, Riker, the Crushers, and perhaps most notable, Brett Spiner's Data.
Will Wheaton.
Oh, yeah, as Wesley Crusher. You know, honestly, like, even a guy like Will Wheaton, who literally, I guess, is only known for this show and the Big Bang Theory.
That's why it's like, right. Don't forget Will Wheaton.
Right. I mean, but literally he's made a career on being like the annoying kid a lot of people hate on in TNG.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know what I mean? But he is kind of a geek and like science literate culture figure. I don't mind Will Wheaton as much as people hate on this guy, I will say that.
I know there's a lot of hate out of him. I don't know why. Like, from what I've seen, he seems like an alright guy.
For like, I really don't get why. Other, I guess I could get it if I was watching this and I'm like, oh, Wesley again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm gonna deal with him. Just wanna fuck his mom. Anyway, but in the article that I mentioned that before, Fox actor Leonard Nimoy remarked that Paramount thought it could catch lightning in a bottle again. And you know what? Maybe they kind of thought that they could. But I'm going to tell you right now, they really did. Like, when you look at Brett Spiner and Patrick Stewart and LeVar Burton and the performances that get put in by from Worf,
oh, yeah.
Right? From Riker. These are people who that I feel like maybe they weren't paying attention to, like, every single thing they could do on stage or screen beforehand. But when it comes to what they do here in these seven seasons, it is, chef's kiss.
It really is. Like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's good acting. It's a good storyline. And, like, and it's episodic, too. Because, like, I mean, yes, you do. You can watch it front.
Not always, but yeah, but exactly. Very much so.
Like, you can watch it. Like, there is a main story going throughout, like, the entire series. Yeah. But if you want to just throw an episode on, you won't be lost. No matter, almost, like, you won't be very lost, right? You'll be able to just understand the gist of it. And it's kind of like, you know, a detective show or whatever, but it's not, you know. But it is similar to it, though, in a way.
Yeah, like there's a lot of love for detectives here, right? When we talk about holodeck episodes and stuff like that, we will talk about how Data has a love of Sherlock Holmes, so much so that Moriarty gets consciousness and tries to leave the holodeck.
Yes.
You know, and even to the extent that when Stewart will go into it at times, he plays a hard-boiled PI. You know what I mean? Like, there is a love of detective stories and things here.
There is.
And I think that kind of mystery of the week feel does come in a lot of these episodes, right? And that is why it is very easy to put an episode of TNG on and just get lost in your 45 minutes and, you know, if you're watching it on DVD or something, I guess, you know, but get lost in that hour and just see what happens, right? I really feel like that's part of what makes it all that much more easier to do and a beloved offering overall. But like we said with the Muppets, these guys kind of felt that they could bet on themselves and went to first run syndication.
So when you say first run syndication, you mean that like it just is like anybody
independently
can
independently stations could purchase the rights to air that material. Yes.
Okay, like so like when it first came out there was multiple channels that had it, or
I think what it would be is that the market, typically whoever had the first rights got it within the market. Because if I'm the ABC affiliate and I've been airing Star Trek for 20 years and I know there's first run syndication for Star Trek, I'm buying that.
Yeah, yeah.
Instantaneously, I am. So why is the NPC program director going to go buy it?
I mean, what's the difference than just them pitch it? I guess they just made it before.
They did make pitches. So
yeah.
When it comes down to it, I think the best offer that they got, or at least the one I was able to find out some info on, was the one from Fox. Fox offered them a 13-episode deal, which when you look at the production of about $1 million an episode, it just wasn't going to be able to fund the whole season. So they were like, well, it. We know we have the market base to sell. And I think the other thing that was a big driving factor for them in the market was home video release and things like that. So
it'd be like if Star Wars was like, we're going to make a series, you know, and no one's going to buy it right
now. Oh, Star Wars made a couple different dumb television series.
True and bombed, yeah.
We'll talk about droids and like that one day, trust us. But one of the things I do think that's important to note is that for a lot of fans, when it comes into watching orders and things like this, they will have pre-selected things or, you know, a TLDR of this is what happens in seasons 1 and 2, or start watching at the very end of this season, right? Or whatever, and pick up in season 3. And a lot of that is unfortunately because Roddenberry, who had held on to as much of these rights and retained as much intellectual control over this property as he could, in some people's minds, may have really had a bit of a stranglehold on it. In the 24th century, he wanted protocols to be between, you know, the main crew member. He wants it to be that, like, there's no interpersonal conflict or...
Yes, I read about that, where it's like, yeah, he's like, humans have got over their emotions, essentially.
They're quibbles. And it's like, but that's not how you write dynamic television. It's just not. And even beyond that, Star Trek as a television show is one that is in the sci-fi premise for its fantastical, amazing elements, absolutely. But it uses that, I don't know if you know this, Brad, as a backdrop to talk about ethical, moral issues, social, political issues. But
almost better than any series out there.
Like, but maybe most notably as a series for that, right? Like, so yeah, why is it that you would take away one of the easiest linchpins in this character is of one, you know, sex,
I guess,
and this of another? Outside circumstances could change that, right?
From what I understand, or from what I read, all right, and like I didn't like read into this, right? He was saying that like he thought a good show doesn't need that, you know, like the show is good enough to where just like the storylines themselves don't need like interpersonal conflicts. We don't need love stories and stuff like that. The plots themselves are enough to carry the show. And like, I kind of agree with him on that, man.
I do to an extent. And I will say that I think this show later on, free of his hands, holding a grip onto that rule, does that, right? There are love interests, but they're not driven as a character by those things.
Well, if you look at like most TV shows, like if you think about it, the first, like, yes, I guess most of them surround like one person's trying to like get with another person. Like in general, the main character is trying to, you know, fall in love or whatever. But a lot of shows, right?
Right.
Or they're already like, but if they aren't or whatever, let's just say usually there's some like other theme, right, for the first few seasons. And then eventually it just gets to like, this person's hooked up with this person, this person's getting with this person, there's a marriage for this, there's a marriage for that.
Right, the like, relationship dynamics of characters become more important than the events of the actual narrative
exactly.
of the show. I can understand, especially where writing for television goes 20 years from this, definitely, you know.
Exactly.
Right.
So maybe he had like a vision, you know, there in a way. Yeah,
I think he has a very good number of things in mind. But when it comes to writing television in 1986, it may not have been the best idea.
Sure. Definitely.
But like Breaking Bad, right? People say that seasons 1 and 2 are a little too slow or just not the best or whatever else. But I want to say one of the biggest themes that really sticks is that big uppercut bang intro of the first episode of the season, right? And then we kind of go through and lead off and then bridge between seasons with a two-parter at the end and going forward into the next, right? That's something that will kind of consistently stay throughout our narrative here in TNG. And I really like it as a storyline narrative, right? I really think it bridges things excellently. And like I said, he initially hired these four writers to come into rooms with him. But like I said, that iron tight grip, because while he may have had the right idea and the right direction, overdoing it sometimes, I think, is more of the problem than the idea itself.
For sure.
Because he rewrote 2/3 of season one.
What?
And two of those original four Star Trek writers quit.
I can imagine, yeah, if he's like, fuck you guys, I'm going to rewrite 2/3 of your work.
Right, exactly. And Star Trek TNG also has the denomination of holding two episodes that not even by today's standards, but definitely do have overtones of racism to them.
Really?
One, really, really directly with Code of Honor, in which an alien race is portrayed exclusively by black people. And when you look at the architecture and iconography on their ship or home planet or whatever it's supposed to be, it is, you know, like neo-tribalist or whatever, right? It's like stereotypical tribal African look.
But were they doing this to, like, show that, though? Like, was that intentional?
I think like a lot of things, it may have been done, and I am not trying to excuse this away.
Sure,
I'm
not. Sure, but, yes, exactly.
But as an understanding eye, I could see it as like, well, you know what? Why don't we just have a planet that's like, so we can hire a bunch of African Americans for these roles?
Like, they're trying, because, like, okay,
let's just hire a bunch of black people.
Just like you said, they kind of like
give them, and then they were like, okay, well, what do we do?
Yeah.
Well, let's just get from the Coming to America set, I guess. Like,
yeah,
I could understand it to the extent that they're just like, let's just try to hire these people and do these things and like give these guys a chance. Or something.
No, but, like, I see what you're saying. Like, it's bad. That's bad. It is.
Yeah. But dude, it's like, just, it's not cool.
Well, I mean,
but the other one is, and it's a bit less, but I think it has really good intentions, but when you look at the misgivings that people, I don't want to say who look for things like that, but like, when you see it, it's hard to not see it anymore. The Ferengi. Roddenberry designed the Ferengi to be like a Romulan race, or Klingons, right?
Yeah.
Like an antagonist race.
They're the big baddies.
For the Enterprise crew,
yeah,
right?
The big baddies, yeah.
And the Ferengis as a race are a statement on crass capitalism, late stage capitalism, right? Like hyper capitalism.
No.
But they have really, really big ears and noses. And like
leprechauns? Or wait, no.
Like Jews.
Oh.
People believe that Ferengis have elements of anti-Semitism associated with them.
I just don't
listen.
Let me look at him. Hold
really
on.
Thought that other than the stereotypes of Jews, right? Which is not cool. But like, I was like, oh, that's why, because they're greedy. And then I was like, oh, but they have big ass noses and shit too. Like, it's, I think it is supposed to be more than just they're greedy. Just like, what's his toes in Star Wars? The slave trader in Star Wars, episode one.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a big...
Yeah, and he's got, like, that accent.
He talks like they have these kind of...
Yeah, I never would... Like, okay, when I watched it, I did not associate Jewish people with it at all. I guess if, like, if you're, like, searching for maybe, subconsciously, but...
Exactly. I never thought it either, and then I saw it, and I'm like...
I don't know.
I think a lot of it is in, like, the ugly propaganda depictions of Jewish people classically, right?
Yeah.
Like, they all
have
that. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, very true. Like, the Borat depiction and the stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A really kind of problematic element to season one's writing was the development of Tasha Yar, who is, like, the tactical officer and, you know... Unfortunately, though, she really didn't feel fleshed out as a character, and by the end of season one said that she was going to leave, and they just kind of, like, unceremoniously kill her off. She will come back, but, like, she directly attributed the writing of her character to being why she left. But there were spats with producers a little bit later that kind of point to some sexism and things like
that. Yeah, because, yeah, it was the... 80s, 90s, yeah, I can imagine.
Absolutely. But as Riker actor Jonathan Frakes remarked, and I do agree with this, at this time, TNG was taking risks, and a lot of these things paid off. As example, the Ferengi, although maybe problematic in some eyes, is a well-beloved Star Trek race to this day, right?
I'm not a Trekkie, but like... Yeah, and like I had no problem with them.
But Ferengis have kind of persisted as far as I've been able to ascertain as well.
Yeah.
Like we said before, Data's love of Sherlock Holmes, the holodeck, Data's evil brother of Lore. And in the first moments of the double-length pilot, we see the inclusion of the character Clue. And these episodes feed the series overall for like continuity, but also just bits and pieces of lore that are going to get picked up in Voyager and Deep Space Nine and are pulling back on threads that happened way back in the 60s as well.
That is the one cool thing, is they all kind of connect. And if I'm not mistaken, like, isn't, like, the big bad of every series, like, at the end they become good, and then, like, they're it.
The Klingon Empire does get to peace with the Federation, and that carries out throughout here, although there's plot lines that try to disrupt that at different points as well.
Sure.
And then, like, but not, I would say no, though, because, like, then you have, like, the Romulans who, like, have the Kasparians and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're always like, gonna have, like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. There's just so many factions at play, and then, like, rogue elements within it. Like, within season one, they find a conspiracy to take over the Federation of Planets.
I'm definitely gonna watch the first season. Like, maybe even start it tonight. We'll see.
And I do suggest overall that you watch all seven seasons of this, but I can understand why, like, maybe this isn't where you start. But regardless, throughout its initial season offering, about an average of 10 million homes watched this week to week as it aired.
Wow.
Yes. A show examining morals and ethics, the convergence of thought and matter, artificial intelligence and its capabilities of being considered equal to humans.
Oh, man.
Average 10 million homes. In mid to late 80s America. Mwah.
I bet you it did really shape a lot of...
minds.
Things. Exactly. Yeah, like a lot of like acceptance and stuff came from this show. I guarantee it.
And then reality TV became the biggest thing on television 20 years later. And look where we all now.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Let me grab my dopamine machine and scroll around on Facebook.
Yeah.
We're going to skip ahead a bit here. By the time we get to the end of season four, right? TNG had continues up and downs. Even Dr. Crusher allegedly being fired for being critical of Paramount and writing of the show. That's odd because she's complaining about sexism and not like some of the racist.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. Fair enough. It's fair to be critical of season one. Everybody does it. The writer's strike of 88 had shortened season two, and adding Whoopi Goldberg as a reoccurring character, positioning the Borg as long-term important figures in the mythos, unrest with the Klingons, the return of Dr. Crusher at the beginning of season three, and some could argue this is where you need to watch the beginning of the series, right?
Just start at season one. Like, what? Just start at season one.
I agree, but I'm just saying there's a number of people who are like, watch the last three episodes of season two and go forward. I mean, I'm dead ass serious.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of a series where people are like, well, The Office, a lot of people say...
The Office, yeah. There's tons of them now.
To miss the first season.
Don't start till season three, doesn't get that
good.
Yeah,
I guess.
People do that all the time. Or quit after season four.
But you gotta know the backstory.
That's even worse.
You know? Yeah.
Watch half the We also have some relevant discussions about AI and its role, and data-centric plots really kind of start with Measure of Man, which is one of the best works of science fiction overall. It occurs in season three, but... You know, The Offspring in season four, I believe. Roddenberry is taking a step back at the end of season three, like we were talking about. And, you know, by the end of season three, the Borg has captured Picard and dealt the Federation its worst military loss in a significant amount of time. I believe the ship count is 39.
Really?
But it is like a transformative moment. And like when they spin off for Voyager or Deep Space Nine, the head of that crew will have witnessed what happened that day and like that. Like it is, I say, a forever changing moment that happens. He's rescued off at the very early beginnings of season four, and this affects him. It's really getting into its stride, and you get more and more different things that kind of continue on. Like, although there's rest within the Klingon, you know, empire, it gets to the point that Worf actually has to, like, let go of his duties and join up with the Klingons to defend the empire and things like that. It gets to a point as well where Romulans start to bring on a lot of different espionage details. And even though there's an uneasy peace with the Kasparians, there becomes like this double-ended espionage tale that runs out throughout portions of this series. There's just so much of this that I...
Well, yeah, seven seasons, I mean.
Absolutely. Even by the point in season six... which a lot of people, and like, this is prime Star Trek TNG, where okay. like at the big finale points where they're going into the 1900s and Mark Twain is catching parts of a conversation yeah. with Data. See, this,
I thought so. There was like a time where they like goes back in time and stuff,
right? The 1900s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay.
Even though my younger self was really kind of misinformed about this, I feel, for a long time, because I used to call this C-SPAN in space, right? And there are a lot of times that this episode turns into a courtroom drama in space or whatever it may be, right? Like there are a lot of
That's what I was saying, yeah,
bureaucratic and elements of this thing, but those things are riveting and compelling and informative to the human experience. And as I grew and matured with age, I think I watched more and more that I never knew was inspired by this, learned from more and more people I never met that were directly inspired by and in love with this. And to this day, unfortunately, I've never seen it. And when you asked me to cover this, Brad, I was a little intimidated, but now I found myself really, really intrigued. So my suggestion for all of you out there is check out Star Trek TNG, and this universe goes on Voyager, Deep Space Nine, Enterprise, and then eventually to this day on All Access and things like that. They're doing Picard, Discovery's ending this year. The Lower Decks may have ended already, I'm not sure, but absolutely, man, check out more Star Trek, because I know I will be soon.
Yeah, I definitely will be too. Like I said, I'm probably going to watch the first season or start watching it again. I don't know if I'm going to watch, like, the newer stuff is more Star Wars-y. I will say that. I have watched.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, not to say that it's bad, but it's not. Yeah. No, but actually, man, thank you so much for covering this, because you just, like, sparked my re-interest into this. I need to, like, yeah. I'm definitely going to probably binge this series.
And thank you, Orange River, Red Letter Media. Thank you guys for the, like, 12 hours of YouTube videos I watched for this.
Did they deal with any cannibals, perchance?
I think there's an episode where there's two races that Riker's, like, trying to, like, help settle a dispute with or whatever. And at the end, like, they even at one point capture Riker and they're like, oh, sorry, wrong species. Why wouldn't you court-martial them and like that at that point? But even beyond that, at the end, the other race is like leaving and they're talking to Tasha Yar or whatever, I think, and they're like, oh yeah, we're about to go have this big reptile for dinner, and one of the other diplomats is missing. And really? Paramount got a ton of letters like, why the did you let that guy eat that guy?
Yeah.
It didn't really happen, everybody. It's okay. It's probably a joke.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, the Aztecs didn't joke about it, though.
But, yeah, they will really eat your heart for the sun god.
I'm not going to, like, get too crazy. But, there's some kind of graphic stuff. We just talked about kind of graphic stuff just right there. But, anyways, let's get into them. The Aztecs. So, the Aztecs, or the Triple Alliance, or the Nahuatl speaking people, were a group of three city-states that formed an empire in the 15th and early 16th century. So they weren't around very long, like 100 years. Like, well, the empire, right? But after that, because of that, they were conquered by the invading Spanish conquistadors. I hate them. They're bad. But I also love the history of them, and I think it's a really cool sounding word. One of these days, we're going to talk about different conquistadors, because I don't want this to be too dark, you know? Like, I mean, and not saying those episodes are going to be dark either, but like,
it's more of a celebration of Aztecs.
Yeah, I just want to talk about the Aztecs, because they're really cool people and everything like that. So the name Aztec actually comes from the Nahuatl word, Etzlan. I'm hoping I'm saying these words right, but like I'm probably gonna mess up some. Obviously, you know, these are some hard to me. The like Native American, especially Mesoamerican natives, their languages just are like so hard for me, man. Because it's just like a huge like bunch of different consonants together and stuff. Yeah,
but I don't envy it. I've said this before,
but you know, like that was probably, you know, to them English is probably crazy, because it is crazy. But anyways,
it's said to be really hard to learn.
Yeah. But this name, the word Etzlan, it means white land or land of white herons or the place of herons. And this probably harkens back to their northern Mexican origins. It's thought that they actually came from the northern plains and deserts of Mexico. And
so like that today would be like Juarez or what, like?
The northern Mexican plateau, like that whole general area, like their capital is what Mexico City is now. That's where their capital was. So, yeah.
Oh, one for one. Dope. Okay, yeah, so it's central Mexico kind of too, or no?
Yeah,
no?
Well, that's where they started in northern Mexico, right? That's where like their group originally formed at, right? That was like early like nomadic times. They were like hunter-gatherers at this time, right? So they're really, we don't have too much like really about Aztecs at all. Like we do have a good bit.
They're more like a tribe at this point than a society.
Yeah. Exactly. So, like, man, the Spaniards really wiped out a lot of their history, especially because they were so centralized. And they weren't, you know, they were an empire for only like 100 years at that time, you know? So, like, yeah. I mean, they were around for more of that, but, like, you know, like a centralized. Yeah. They're also called the Tenochca or the Mexica, where, you know, the name Mexico comes from. And it's actually the name derived from Metzlayapan. I hope I'm saying that right, which is a mystical name they gave for Lake Texcoco, which this lake will come. Okay. Yes, this lake, I don't think is actually even a thing anymore. Like, it's not even, it's just, you know, like, it's all. It's a city, like actually, like because Mexico City, it's huge.
Right,
like, Mexico City is huge. Right. Let's just put it that way.
Absolutely. Right?
So yeah, there is no more lake in Mexico City. There was a lake at that time, though, that was connected to multiple other lakes. I guess there's some small ones. There's Texcoco. Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually to like the east a little bit of Mexico City, if you look up Texcoco. Okay. This area was like the capital city, known as Tenochtitlan, which that had like pyramids and everything there. Like when you think of like, you know, the Mesoamerican things, you think of like the pyramids and all that. Like that's where that was. You know, there was other cities and whatnot that had that. But like this was the capital city, and it was like a pretty big city. This wasn't some like, you know, like they weren't hunter-gatherers at that time. You know, like by the time they had their capital, they were like, it was a well-established empire with like, you know, full economy and everything.
It's a city-state, right? Essentially.
Yes, it was a city-state. Yeah.
Okay.
So this actually happened around like the 12th century. It started around the 12th century, should I say. So like it's actually kind of, this is the medieval period, right? This is what we just talked about with the Byzantines and stuff. Like this was like around that time. This is when these hunter-gatherers started migrating south into central Mexico. And at the time, the big rulers in the area was a civilization known as the Toltecs, and their capital was at a place called Tula. And I'm sorry, Kyle, I didn't look up exactly where this place was.
You're okay, my bad.
But it's all right, because I usually do like to do that. Like
I do kind of figure like you might know the shorthand.
One of my favorite things in books when I'm reading books is having a map at like the beginning or end, especially in fiction books, just so I can get like
Tolkien and.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's the, oh man, I love that. But yeah, so these Toltec people, though, they were advanced too, like, at the time. I mean, this is the 12th century. Like,
yeah, they sound familiar. I was going to say that too, but like, not enough that, like, I know they're not in Civ, right? But like,
exactly.
Yeah, no, they're not, I don't in think Civ, they would be. Yeah. Who gives a f? No. But I'm just saying, like, I've heard the name, but like, they don't ring to me like Aztec, Mayan, Inca. But they are that, right? They are a Native America, as in North just like America, yep, Mexican just like thing, right?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, these are the same people. Like, I mean, this is the thing. Like, when I talk about all these empires, it's really just the same kind of, like, group of people. I mean, obviously, they're different people. But, like, if you take over an area, you know, like, I mean, yeah, like, if you take over a somewhat, like, close area to you, it's going to be essentially... I mean, like, yes, gene pools can be, you know, more restricted and stuff, but still.
Right.
It's not like they're going across the sea.
Right.
So, anyways, around the 12th century, though, as these people, these the early Aztecs were coming down, which were actually called the Chichimec, I think, is where what researchers think, should I say, was the original Aztec people, right? These people called the Chichimec. They probably didn't end the Toltec civilization. Like, it was probably some other hunter-gatherers or some other nation or city-state around that area. But, like, they just kind of took advantage of them kind of, you know, being destroyed. So they, like, they came in once the...
Oh, okay.
The Toltecs, like, once Tula got destroyed, like, that city got destroyed, they kind of settled on the ruins. Not on the ruins, but, like, you know, around.
Adjacent. Right.
Right. The ruins of it, yeah. But legend has it that one of their gods named Huitzilopochtli. I hope that I'm going to say that this is the god of war. That's the first, only time I'm going to say that name. And he's the god of war from here on out.
So, right.
Yes. Right. So when the god of war, he told the elders then that this wasn't their permanent home. And they have to keep on looking until they see an eagle perched on a nopal cactus with a serpent in its beak. And if you look at the Mexican flag, okay, that's on the Mexican flag. But, nice. Yeah. So they kept looking, right? And from there, they went on a pilgrimage. And this is like, so... I didn't look at the exact, like, day that was supposed to have happened, but at least, like, you know, 25 years. Because in 1325, right, we're talking, you know, we're going, this might be over a 100-year journey. It kind of sounds like Moses to me, in a way. You know, it's almost like they go on this, like, pilgrimage to try to find their
homeland. Is that homeland. 40 days and 40 nights, though, or that's Jesus?
That's, yeah. I think it's, like, a while. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah. But they go on a long journey. Let's just say that. And they finally land upon Lake Texcoco. And, like, this is the legend, right, how they founded the city and stuff. So maybe it actually didn't happen. But eventually, like, it did happen, obviously, because they're there.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, like, we've noted multiple times, like, once you get to a body of water, civilization springs.
Sure. Right?
So, like,
yeah,
if I'm the leader, I'm like, oh, the that eagle.
Well, yeah.
With the snake. There it is, guys. Let's set up shop.
And apparently, they found this eagle on this cactus on this island on
the Even lake. Better.
So, they're like, well, we got to set up, you know, I mean, I guess Tyre was one when we were talking about Alexander, but, like, usually you don't set up.
Yeah, right. And,
even, I guess, on a lake. You don't set a city up on a lake.
That's true.
On an island on a lake.
Next to the lake.
Yeah, next to a lake. Yeah. But so they set up on this island, right? And from there, they kind of just, like, settled in. And that was Tenochtitlan. That was the, like, the beginning of the Aztecs. Like, the Aztecs were,
the origins. That's your season one.
Yeah. Eventually, there was an alliance. But, you know, that at that point, they saw that eagle, right? They built a temple at that location. And then, like, there were smaller islands around that that, like, they started building on, right? And we'll talk about, again, they're on an island. And it's not a big island. So how are they supposed to grow their crops? Right?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that in a minute. All right. But but Tenochtitlan continued to grow and establish power. So, like, over the next 100 years, eventually, they didn't have wheels. That was, like, really the wheels and metal, because there wasn't really, like, good places to get metal.
Forged steel.
And yeah. Right. So they used obsidian blades, which, like, that is what limited them.
That's really
wrong. Yeah, we'll talk about those in a second too. Yes. But yes, around 1428 to 1440, A ruler named Itzcoatl ruled the city, and he ended up forming an alliance with two of the neighboring cities, right? And this is where the Triple Alliance comes from. And
these, right, I was going to say, this is your alliance.
Exactly,
right?
Yep. And these two cities were Texcoco and Tlacopan. So once these guys were united, there's really like no power in the area that could match like this newly formed alliance, right? This is two of like the bigger city states in the area. And from that, now they're like the Saoli, the Aztecs. And Tenochtitlan was like the capital of the three, like I said. And through conquest, they started really taking over this really large area, but also through trade too. It wasn't just through conquest. Like they were, yes, they were known as like these brutal savages, like in accounts and stuff. We'll get into the end, like we started, about the whole like human sacrifice, cannibalism, whatnot. But they did a lot of trading too, though. Like they were people too. Like they weren't just like these bloodthirsty animals that were like killing.
Influence of culture, right?
Exactly, yeah. And they came to rule over an empire over 80,000 square miles, or 207,000 square kilometers. So like a big, like a really big area, right? Like most of Mexico. Yeah.
And how populated is it technically at this point?
So this was like, okay, well, Tenochtitlan itself covered about 5 square miles or 13 square kilometers at its peak. And it was estimated around 140,000. So like, it doesn't seem like a lot, but at that time, like that's bigger than
at the time it
anywhere
is.
Else. The most densely populated city in history of Mesoamerica at that time. Only the Incas really like matched the size of their population of the whole empire. So like the whole empire, like you asked, that estimated to be around, it was around 400 to 500 small city states, right? So pretty big area and an estimated population of around 5 to 6 million people. So like it's, yeah, like that's a good bit. There was a king, and then like there was a bunch of like lords, I guess you could call them, around that like paid tribute to him, you know. Essentially, yeah. Yep. Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, this is why what I said earlier, like, these people came in and, like, took over. They didn't really, like, you take over, but it's not, like, you're not changing much. Like, you're just changing who you pay taxes to, essentially, right? You know, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they did mix, obviously, but yeah. But yeah, so like I was saying earlier, they were adept at warfare, but the trade, and especially their agriculture, made them really the powerhouse that they were. And the reason why their agriculture was so great was because of the intensive gardening style that they had. And that was made possible from the soils that came in to the lake from like the mountains and stuff. You know, the mountains in the area washed down all the nutrients and sediments and everything and deposited into this lake.
Right.
And what they would do and how they would grow crops, right? Like, this is the craziest thing to me. They would dredge the lake, like the shallower parts, right? And build up these like raised beds essentially on the lake because they're on an island, right? They're on an island on the lake.
Right.
And they started building up all these raised beds, you know, expanding across the city, expanding out the city, and made these super rich, perfectly irrigated beds to grow all their crops on.
Oh my God.
Yes.
So it's two birds, one stone. You're giving yourself plots to go out on, but the island is also kind of expanding because you're building these right off the edge of the island.
Yeah, you're essentially, yeah, exactly. They're like expanding the island.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
And I mean, in other populations, I don't know if they've done exactly this, you know, but they've expanded. Like, I know, like, the Netherlands, they've, like, built a bunch of, like, land, you know, or even Venice. Think of Venice, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, dude. Like, it is so crazy to think. And they're doing this. What are they doing? They try to drudge?
I mean, just, like, wooden tools? Yeah. Simple hand and stuff. Tools. Like, yeah, they're just, like, you know, like, yeah.
Holy shit. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, it's insane, man. Yeah. Like, they, so, like, you, it's almost aquaponics, right? Where you use, like, the fish poop and all that.
That's kind of what I was wondering, too. Is that lake water funneling in there?
Yeah, all that. That's what I mean. The irrigation, right? Like, it's like they have it all irrigated. Like, the lake water is watering the crops. So, like, they don't even have to worry about water, like, droughts and things like that. I mean, maybe they had to worry sometimes if the lakes were low.
If it got too low, right. But how the is that going to happen?
Exactly.
And even at that, you just transfer some out, right?
Yeah.
You just collect it, gather, and spread. Like,
yeah.
That's dope.
It is. It's crazy. So these things, they're called chinampas, and floating gardens is what it translates to. And like, they did this across, like, not just that lake, but, like, there was a series of lakes. But, I mean, it was mostly at Tenochtitlan. But, like, they did employ that method in other parts of the area. And there's these lakes that I'm looking at the map. There is still some lakes. I don't know if it's the exact ones that I'm talking about right now, but there was like a series of them that connected. Like it was almost like a chain that they could like transport all their goods, you know, through natural canals connecting the lakes.
I was going to say like canals.
Yeah. Right? And artificial ones that they built, you know? So like they also built canals that like connected lakes and all that. So they make these, this awesome, like beautiful, rich soil that they can just grow things, multiple crops in a year and just transport out. This is why they became this crazy empire. You know, they were able, like, right. If you can feed your population really well, you're going to have that advantage, especially in like, hundreds of years ago and everything. Yeah.
I mean, and in general, like at this time, food and shelter are really the only things in your Maslow hierarchy it needs, right?
Yeah.
Extent of like what governance can provide for you, right?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the government. Yeah. So it's not really like exactly understood what the like how the government worked like exactly. But they do know that there was like these divisions of tribes in the empire within the city and outside of the city called capuli or big houses. And some of the scholars think that these were like family units that were point to more like a more of an egalitarian form of society, right? So more of like, you know, kind of like a socialist kind of society in a way, you know, like everybody like trades and barters and everybody's like they're sharing it. But really
kind of like the planetary.
Yeah. Just like TNG. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But really like, I mean, there was definitely a social hierarchy, right? There was like the farmers and there was the nobles, right? Because there was a king. And if there's a king, then there's nobility. And if you have nobility, right. Yeah. And like, I mean, maybe in the surrounding areas, it might have been more egalitarian. It definitely was, right? But like in the centralized area, there was the king. And it was more like I said earlier, it was probably like a monarchy with a like a feudal type system where there's minor lords in the area that collected tribute to pay to the king himself, right? And then like, you know, they would kind of keep some of that tribute for themselves. And that's how they, right. Yeah. And that's not to say though that there wasn't like a huge political organization though. There was courts, there was tax collectors, there was even mail and other civil services. So like these aren't savages. Like nice. I said, this is like an advanced civilization. This is like,
absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And like the Romans, the Aztec religion was syncretistic. So that means that it brings other gods into their pantheon as they encounter other religions, right? Okay, so like the Romans did that too, like with the Greeks, right? You know, like they're, oh yeah, this, the Greeks were like that as well. With Alexander, when he went over to Egypt and there, you know, Zeus was this god that was actually over, you know, they worshiped, they're like, oh yeah, your god, that's Zeus. But but they had like, man, I started looking, there's literally like, actually Wikipedia was if you go to the Wikipedia for the Aztec gods, it's like this gigantic, there's like over 100 at least, you know, and I'm obviously not going to talk about all of them, but I'll talk about some of the big ones. Like I said, the god of war, Huitzilopochtli. I said it twice, but it's the god of war. And then there's Tonatiuh, which is the god of the sun god, like you spoke about earlier, and Tlaloc, which is the god of rain, and Quetzalcoatl, which is the feathered serpent. And I think he might have been the one. That's
pretty familiar.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, he's the one with the like the whole why they thought Cortez was a god. They thought he was Quetzalcoatl. But he's the feathered serpent, and he's the god of vegetation, which we'll talk about Cortez another day. But yes, and he's actually closely associated to Tlaloc, who, like I said, is the god of rain. So, you know, the god of vegetation and rain. So they still relied on rain, obviously. But like it's like they had that crazy irrigation system still.
right.
But so this religion and a lot of religions, actually, if you like go through time, and someday I might cover this, but if you go through time, religion in general takes a specific, it evolves in a specific way. You start out worshiping like the sun, and then you start worshiping like things on the ground, and then you start like personifying the deities. So at first they're just like an abstract thing, then they become like human-like, you know, maybe they become half human, half animal, like in Egypt or whatnot, or here. And then after that they become fully human. And then after that, they become from a polytheistic to, or, you know, full human like the Greeks or whatever. Or, you know, they look fully human. And then they become monotheistic. And then that's where we're at right now. I mean, if you look at like so many different religions throughout history, that's kind of the process or the progress a lot of
the trajectory. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
So they're at that point right now where they're, you know, they're at the Egyptian point. That's where their religion, that's where their evolution was at. And at that point, there was a lot of human sacrifice. If you look at a lot of places throughout the world, if at that point, you know, when they're at that type of religion, there was a lot of human sacrifice going on. For whatever reason, that's what happened at that time.
And I'm sure as a lot of other practices of religion were of the day, there was a lot of fasting. There was a lot of offerings. There was a lot of manifesting.
Yes, there was tons of,
a lot of things that in practice either doesn't happen or has a complete different context in practiced religion today.
Exactly.
So, like, when you say sacrifice, it does super sound Indiana Jones, culty.
Well, yeah, because these people, like, I mean, it was like...
But in the day, well, it wasn't... it's like, if we don't give one random person away, all the hell are going to die.
Exactly. They literally believed if they do not, the gods craved blood. They have to give blood to them or our city will get destroyed if we do not give the gods these sacrifices.
You want locusts next year, Steve? You need to give us your firstborn, dude. So,
exactly.
Cough them up.
Exactly. The Spaniards made it, like, and then you'll even see, like, when you, like, watch, like, the History Channel stuff on the Aztecs, like, they'll talk about these sacrifices, like, crazy. And they did do sacrifice. Don't get me wrong. They sacrificed people, but it wasn't, like, the main theme of their culture. It wasn't, like, everybody was just bloodthirsty. Let's go out and kill people. Yeah.
We doing Thursday night. You know what I'm doing Thursday night. Sacrifice.
Like, a yearly holiday stuff, you know? Like, it was, like, to appease the gods. Like, that, I mean, and of course, like, that is obviously crazy. Like, nowadays in a modern society to hear about that and to think about that is crazy. I guess they would, like, mix blood of the victim into, like, flour and make, you know, food or eat it, I guess. So they were cannibalistic in some ways. There's reports of that, I guess. Engravings of it. I don't think they ate the heart. They just presented the heart. So what they did is in one of the ceremonies, because there was a bunch of different ways that they sacrificed people, but one of the ways they sacrificed people, and the one you see a lot, is they'd bring the victim up to the top of a pyramid temple, and they put him on the stone altar on top, and then they'd spread the victim out, and then a priest would take this sharpest obsidian blade, and these obsidian blades are like as sharp as like a surgical razor, right? Like they're like these black, crazy looking volcanic rock blade. Yeah.
When I was at my cult last year and I got mine. Oh, wait, I said too much.
We don't talk about God. God, I told you after.
I know. I'm sorry.
Anyways. So the priest would take his obsidian blade and he would slice the chest open and then quickly tear the heart out while it was still beating and like hold it towards the sky, towards the sun, to present it towards the sun god. And then they would kick push the victim's body. I don't know if they kicked it, but they'd push it down the pyramid steps. And at the base, there was this stone called the Coyoshakwi stone. And this stone was called that because there's this whole legend where the god of war's sister, who was Coyoshakwi, and she died at the base of a mountain, fell down, got killed and fell down the mountain. So they're redoing this ritual. That was they're reinterpreting this ritual to honor the gods. And that's why, that was one of their rituals. But there's also like other sacrifices to honor the gods, like mostly to the god of the war and the sun god. But there was this one that I read about, which is kind of crazy, man, which, the god of rain, like I was talking about, they required tears of the young to, you know, satisfy him, right? That the god of rain needed tears of the young. So they would, like, take the young, you know, young boys and, like, they would sacrifice them. They'd end up killing them. But on the way, they'd make sure they cried a lot.
Right, yeah. Like,
you got to bring the rain. Exactly, you know. So you got to torture them and make them cry really
What so, the
Yeah. So, like, I mean, yeah. It was kind of, there's some messed up stuff. But, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know why I wanted to end it on this part. I'm sorry. There was other ways I could end it. And I'm just like, this is where my research ended. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna, I don't know. Yeah.
Let's just say it. Like, unfortunately, in a lot of the media depicted for a very long time, like you were saying it, man, like that's ripped straight out of Indiana Jones of, you know, ripping ever beating heart and lifting.
Like when you think exactly, like there is, you know, some truth to that kind of crazy stuff. Like, you know, and like it was ritual sacrifice. Like that's, unfortunately, that's what happened around.
Well, right. And because we react to it in the way that we do, it becomes a trope within us displaying tribalism because we don't understand it or whatever it may be or whatever else.
Exactly.
And then it becomes like I don't want to say misappropriated culture, but to an extent, like, it is, because it becomes our media trope instead of being a real religious event.
Yeah, like anytime you're filming, you know, Mexico, it's sepia and all that. It's got that sepia filter on it.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that is because you're not actually in Mexico and you have to make it look more, you know, more desertous than it actually is. You know,
yeah, that's true.
I think, right? Like, if it's clear, open blue sky, it doesn't look like harsh conditions, which Mexico is probably typically portrayed in.
No, definitely. I was trying to lighten the situation. No, like, serious. It is, like, I mean, they were a very interesting civilization. And
absolutely.
That, like, and I don't want to, like, that was a part of it, though. That was a big part of it. But, like,
it was.
It's crazy that, like, I mean, we're going to get into it. I'm going to talk about Cortez probably pretty soon. And we'll get into, like, how they, like, what, how quickly and, like, what happened to them afterwards. It's crazy. But, yeah.
Are we going to talk about the Incas and the Mayans too?
We will definitely. Yeah, I want to cover all three of them. I've always I loved them before my love of Rome. Like, yeah,
right.
Yeah, so like we'll definitely cover all three of them for sure. Yeah,
I definitely am looking forward to that.
Me too.
And with that, we look forward to you reaching out to us on our social medias, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and on Patreon, where you can get early access to our episodes and you can find them uncensored.
Are we missing any of these social medias? I feel like we've got them all.
Oh, I see. All right, you're doing a bit.
Yeah, is that
I was going to say, we don't have an X. We don't have an X.
Oh, yeah. Well, Twitter.
Elon Musk.
Exactly.
We do have an X, but we don't use it.
No, nope, so and we won't.
Don't ever hit it up, because we ain't ever going to hit it up again.
We ain't going to see it.
Yeah, pretty much. Make sure you give us a rate and review on your podcast platform of choice. Not only does it help out the show, but it helps us find new listeners. For Brad, I am Kyle, and we will see you again here soon.
See ya.
Blamity blam.
Brain soda.